think you'd better do what he says, Mr. Kenny.
You have 60 seconds to comply. This is minute 5.
Part man?
Part machine.
All pod.
This minute begins with one of the cops saying they're going to manage this department right into the ground, and ends with the chief saying, Murphy.
So, this is the, this is going to be the all-nude special.
Yeah, naked times.
naked sexy times.
I actually had a lot to say about that and just really went into a deep dive on nudity and media and society, and it's quite interesting, I hope, to other people.
I went in a very specific deep dive into nudity of different media, but I would definitely love to hear your notes on it. My deep dive was very much specifically on the oeuvre of one Mr. Paul Mad German Verhoeven.
Yeah, well, I guess we can cover both bases there. So I took a more broader cultural approach.
Yeah,
I mean, nudity as a concept is a fascinating thing because it's purely cultural. Mm. We all have strong feelings about it, whether we're consciously aware of it or not. To the point that Christianity needed to give the concept of shame an origin story. It's kind of a big thing in the Bible.
Yeah, the forbidden fruit of knowledge and Adam's trouser snake. Sorry, the other snake.
The other snake, yeah.
I'm probably going to throw in so many double entendres.
Oh, yeah. But it's not something we're born feeling. You know, it's something we're taught. And I actually quite distinctly remember as a kid, you know, being very young and I got out of the bath and I just walk around naked. And then at some point, Dad was making fun of me and I just went, oh, should I feel ashamed of this? And there it was, just solidified forever. I should feel shame.
That is very much a... It feels like a product of the British colonialism in the modern day era. It's like, you know, British, like, you got to be prim and proper, and that's probably transferred off into Americans, like, conservatism, you know, where it's like, you can have explosions and guns and violence, like in RoboCop, but how dare you have titties?
Oh, the funniest example of censorship is NBC with Hannibal, which I will talk about Hannibal some more later. But there is a scene where there are two blood eagles. And for those not aware, that is a Viking practice in which they cut open the back and pull the ribs outward from the inside to create the appearance of wings.
Then
they place the lungs over the shoulders. It's incredibly complicated and gruesome.
I'm guessing this is not like a, you know, rite of passage, you know, where the person is expected to survive.
Yeah, no, this is definitely an execution practice.
It's the earliest version of Red Bull.
Yes. And so these two naked models are posed at the end of this bed, posed like praying angels, and it's the only thing that NBC had notes on was, could you cover their butt cracks somehow? So they had to digitally paint in more blood so you couldn't see their butt cracks.
Like,
it wasn't even, you know, some people, they don't have proper butt meat going on, so you can actually see the sphincter hole. This is fine. They had, like, proper, you know, butt muscle, you know? It was covered.
Censorship laws are weird, but then again, they'll always tend to be dominated by puritanical, not necessarily people, but definitely puritanical ideas.
I would say America and Britain, probably the biggest perpetrators of this.
We have it down here as well, not necessarily to a certain degree, because we don't necessarily need it, only because we get a lot of our media filtered through America and Britain when it comes to a lot of sex and nudity, which has already been sanitized, and then it gets sometimes an extra step of sanitization over here. That's one of the reasons why Game of Thrones thrived more on pirate, not only just because, like, you get it quicker, but also you get as much as it's uncensored, it's HBO, you get uncensored nudity, whereas when they put it over here, it was on Foxtel, I believe.
Yeah.
It still had to go through the Australian censorship program, and they butchered the sex.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I don't think they butchered the violence, but they butchered the sex and nudity, even though it was going on to pay-per-view. So, yeah, we have our own draconian laws. Well, look at our government. That was a cheap shot, but I'm keeping it.
But if you look at European cinema, you look at Japanese cinema, sex and nudity are played in a very natural way for the most part. And it's just...
Well, this segues into our illustrious filmmaker of this movie, who is a German, who is brought up in the European style of filmmaking. So it makes sense that his take on nudity is not... Okay, well, he definitely has takes on nudity that are provocative, but in this movie, it's just a natural... natural thing.
Yeah, and so this scene in particular, in America, well, what are we going to say collectively? Like, it's not the first world, because, you know, as I said, there's parts of Japan and Europe and...
The collective term I can think of is Western, but I'm not sure how...
Yeah, West, because that still includes Europe and it's complicated. Yeah, it's like America and Britain and its colonies.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of one of the reasons I went for British colonialism, because that's the only term I could think of collectively that would work.
Yes. Those white people.
And it's very puritanical.
In these cultures, we segregate toilets and change rooms when you don't really need to. It's this arbitrary reinforcement of the idea that nudity is inherently sexual instead of simply being a fact of anatomy.
Well, genitals in and of themselves have become politicized and sexualized. This is literally the argument going on with trans people and bathrooms, especially in America, where they're trying to police people's bodies.
Exactly, yeah.
And it's fucking insane. As people do lovely, quite blatantly point out, we don't have gender-specific bathrooms in our own home.
Yeah, it's not like there's a specific need to have different facilities. I mean, even a urinal is not really that necessary.
Yeah, sometimes it's good to actually sit down and, you know, take a load off.
Yes.
Even if it's just to pee.
Yeah, and then you look at animals walking around naked all the time. It's just, see, that's normal. Why are we so offended by our own bodies? But, I mean, I'm looking at my rabbit right now, and he's just, yeah, I can see his butt and everything. And
Except the fact that furries are a thing.
Yeah, true.
And we can literally sexualize anything.
Oh, yeah. So I've recently gotten to the Transformers fandom, and they can fetishize anything. Anything.
Yeah, rule 34.
My favorite quote from a random Tumblr user was, yeah, I live near a military base and I'm into the Seekers, which is the jet type Transformers. And it's like...
Not the band.
It's just a permanent state of frustrated horniness. I'm just like, huh? What? What? No.
This is always... Okay, this is a quick segue. This has always been one of those things where I found it always a bit weird of, like, people like otherkin.
Mm.
And I know I'm talking to a self-identified android. It took me a long time to kind of mention...
Yeah, technically I am an otherkin. Oh my god.
Yeah, no, back when I was a bit more of a centrist douchebag.
Mm.
I'm not sure how much has changed.
Now you're an SJW now, it's fine.
I'm a social justice bard. I amplify the SJWs.
Yeah.
But back when I was learning about trans issues, especially like the old idea of like the biologically diversity, you know, all that stuff. I'm not going to go into the deep dive. But when I was learning about like how biology can affect the mental outcome, you know, dimorphism and what's the other one? Dysphoria.
Yeah.
All that type of stuff. And how your body chemistry can really fuck you up, you know, in those situations.
Mm-hmm.
When I'd hear some... Let's face it, it's the furry community. This is where the other king comes from.
Mm.
Start to use those terms in the same way.
Yeah.
Part of my brain was going, how? That's not genetics. I mean, I've come now to accept that people identify with things in a, not necessarily in a sexual way, but in a personal way, in a emotional way. And I think it's really cool now. I don't really have a hatred for otherkin or anything like that.
Yeah, I definitely, well, yeah, me going through my experience with what I call transhuman dysmorphia.
Hmm.
But yeah, I don't feel human. I don't identify as human. I am not attracted to humans. Hmm. I definitely do see myself as an android, to complete with the desire to serve someone else. And I've seen many therapists. They have no answers. And maybe there is a biological foundation for it. I don't know. But
well, there might also be I'm not a therapist, I'm not saying, but it might also be that thing of, has your upbringing, how you've maybe latched onto characters and things you can relate to.
Mm.
I'm going to crowbar in Star Trek right now, because damn it, I didn't get a chance to do any of my notes.
I mean, we have to mention Star Trek at least once per episode.
Excellent. We're mandatory, it's part of the contract.
Well, shit. That's exactly what I was hoping to spare you from.
But going into that, look at the Slickback episode with the kid that's in Robocop. Is it a kid that's in Robocop 2 that becomes Data, or is that the other Slickback?
No, that's the other Slickback. So that's Timothy, who I wrote a fan fiction about, and you can read that on, yeah.
But that's what I'm talking about, the idea that this kid's gone through a trauma, or a very traumatic thing, and he decided to become Data as a way of processing his trauma. Of course, this is a very simplified idea of that, because this is TV, it's always simplified.
Yeah, but actually a lot of otherkin do go through trauma, and this is their way of dealing with it.
Yeah.
In my case, it's more that the way I lack emotions. Not that I don't have any emotions, but I have a very limited emotional spectrum. Yeah. So I think it's just a culmination of a lot of biological things going on with me. Who can say?
We are like a melting pot of our experiences and biology. And this is why I think it's weird when people want to put people into a box. Like, no, you're male or female. There is no in between.
Mm.
You're this or that. There's no in between. It's like, no, we are numerous shades of grey in that scale.
I mean, even with transsexuality, the idea that you must be born trans and you always identified that way, but now we're discovering, so in my case, I only experienced gender dysphoria in my early 20s because I had a virus which caused an epigenetic change which caused an overproduction of dihydrotestosterone, and that wasn't diagnosed, so I was encouraged to transition without dealing with that, so, you know. Life is what it is. And there's also polycystic ovarian syndrome also causes gender dysphoria in some people. So there's a lot of biological causes for dysphoria that are not just from, you know, in utero. Yeah. It doesn't happen in just in that period of your life.
Our DNA is not set in stone from day one. There are things that can literally change your DNA. There isn't recent studies that have been finding that trauma literally changes your DNA structure.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a different person from the one I was 5-10 years ago.
And yeah, and haven't they also found that it's inheritable?
Yeah, so epigenetic changes.
So trauma of someone else can be passed on.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck, biology?
Yeah, generations of trauma, quite literally.
Oh, we are weird, crazy species, but because we do preface this as the all nuder episode, and
yes.
And the funny thing is, like, the nudity in this minute lasts for less than 2 seconds.
But it's the most focus, you know, it gets the most focus in this minute.
Well, there is other things going on, but yeah, it's a great discussion and it's a great topic.
Yeah, so I was going to say that while the media generally reflects that attitude that nudity is inherently sexual and we're often seeing, particularly women, sexualized in the media a lot.
It's almost like it's hypocritical.
And yet, film and TV can also be a source of subversion.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about, and I think, horror, comedy, and science fiction, they're all the genres that use nudity as a tool in ways other than sexual. So I was thinking in comedy, we have Monty Python's The Meaning of Life. I don't even remember that scene where I've got the quote here. Arthur Charles Herbert Runcie McAdam Jarrett, you have been convicted by 12 good persons and true of the crime of first degree, making of gratuitous sexist jokes in a moving picture.
Yeah.
And he chooses the nature of his execution in which he is chased off a cliff by a mob of topless women in helmets. For some reason.
They're in roller skating gear because they're wearing pads.
Yeah, roller skating. Yeah. For some reason. And, you know, that one,
as an extra layer of irony, they were chasing the gay one. So I'm not sure if he was closeted. He might have been out at that point.
Let's be honest, even gay men love titties, so.
Every gay men love titties. I've heard that several times from several very gay men.
Yeah, it's true. I don't know why. But
because titties are awesome.
Yeah, I mean, as an asexual man, I will say, yeah, I get it. That one I included because it really does walk that line of, oh yeah, you get a little bit of eye candy, but at the same time, it's so bizarre, and especially like the inclusion of the helmet for me is throws this image into complete absurdity. And only British comedy can do that.
Monty Python, I point this out in my other podcast, the Kung Pao Enter the Minute podcast. Go check it out.
Mm.
That absurdism is an incredibly valid form of comedy. And yeah, Monty Python are very well known as an absurdist and subversive media. They tackled a whole lot of subjects. In fact, they snuck a shitload of nudity onto the BBC throughout Flying Circus. And a lot of the nudity was in old what's-his-face, Terry Gilliam's animations.
Oh, right, yeah.
He used a lot of old art and, like, things, you know, would just get snuck past. I think they'd still cut out some of it.
Isn't that funny? You mentioned that. Just thinking of Renaissance art and, say, for example, blanking on the name, I can see it, where
David?
Dave. Well, he's got a little leaf over his junk, I think.
Well, that's the point I was going to make, is actually a lot of Renaissance art got censored by puritanical dogma.
But The one where God is, you know, he's reaching out when he's pointing the finger at Creation of Man.
Creation of Man. Was it Michelangelo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a big old schlanger there. And, you know, you put that in...
Or a fronts piece.
Textbooks for kids. You know, I remember seeing that in school. And yet, seeing an actual penis is just not allowed. I don't understand.
Well, that's... Also, the funny thing when it comes to nudity in Hollywood, it's we say about how Hollywood doesn't like to show nudity, and then when it shows, it's pretty much very exploitive, and it's always the female body.
Mm-hmm.
It's never the front of the man.
No.
Even Game of Thrones, you know, a infamously nude-packed show, never shows Wang.
I think they did at one stage towards the end, because I think people were like, equal opportunity nudity.
Yeah.
And then they responded.
But even Verhoeven's, you know, even when he's had nudity, male nudity. Okay, going specifically back to Robocop, we see a lot of man butt and a lot of man gut.
Yep.
But we do not see a lot of man Wang.
Hmm.
We don't see a Robo Wang.
Well, speaking of Wangs in movies, so there's another comedy called The Greasy Strangler.
Oh, never heard of that one.
Which is this absolutely bizarre, disgusting cult classic. It's produced by Elijah Wood, and it's just, I don't even know how to describe it, but it really does fixate on the body, and especially ugly bodies. You've got these actors who, you know, are overweight, or they're old, or whatever, and you're just, even their costumes, they've cut out pieces to show genitalia, and it's just so weird.
But that brings up a great point, because you're talking about also horror, and a staple of the horror genre, or at least slasher horror, particularly 80s horror, is, you know, the teen have sex, get killed trope, made famous by Scream. Renegade Cut has just done a video about kind of debunking a lot of that stuff.
Mm.
But sex and horror has always had a very close connection. Again, ultimately, when you've got something that's already kind of exploitative and is going to get an R rating just because of blood and gore, why not show some titties?
Yeah, and horror also, more so than any other genre, is about the body.
Yeah.
And it shows the body in a variety of ways. Body horror is a genre unto itself.
Yeah.
You know, The Thing being a prime example of our inherent fear of an alien also. Just that inherent fear of something getting inside of us and controlling us. And
the parasite birth fears, in particularly with Alien. Cronenberg loves his body horror, like transformation horror.
Oh, yeah. Where'd the remote go? Oh, it's in me.
The scene where Grundle is documenting his transformation and starts referring himself as Grundle Fly in the third person is gruesome and delicious, and I love it.
And the trope in horror that intrigues me the most, and I'm basically appropriating a term from another section of art here, because I don't know if there's a name for this trope, but there probably is. The exquisite corpse. And by that, I mean Hannibal exemplifies this perfectly, the NBC version especially, that the human form is at once a work of art, an intricate machine, and nothing more than meat for consumption. Yeah. You know, it strips away every comforting delusion we have about our bodies and shows us what it really is. When you get down to these raw materials, which, you know, is kind of ironic when this brutal honesty is coming from a show that is basically like a pre-Raphaelite painting come to life.
There's definitely body horror in this particular movie.
Yeah, I mean, this is, again, science fiction, but this is almost, sci-fi horror, like Alien, the violation of the body.
Yeah, this movie literally is about the violation of a body and the transformation. Again, it fits perfectly into those horror tropes. The one quick thing I wanted to tell you. So a friend of mine on Facebook posted some really provocative pictures of Mads Mikkelsen, like shirt off, sexy ass ones.
As you will.
So I had to reply with a picture of Wellfleet and going, I'm gay now! I must admit, they were very nice shots.
Yeah, man. Everyone's a little bit gay sometimes. It's fine.
Does play into the whole idea of, like, you know, one of the fascinations with horror is about, like, the things we as a society don't abide by, and yet horror, sci-fi, and comedy as well gives us that playground to kind of deal with those things and play around with them, play around with the ideas of that type of stuff.
Yeah, and actually homosexuality is one of those big fears, and that works its way into horror a lot. And I know so many men who, if they notice a man is attractive, just aesthetic appreciation, just like, am I gay now? And then they...
Dude, gay.
Yeah, like I had a friend who said, oh, you know, I think I might actually be bisexual. And I went, oh, really? That surprises me. I mean, you're going to be married to a woman. Have you never dated men? What do you mean? And he's like, oh, you know, I find some men attractive. Like, do you want to date them? No. Would you want to, like, touch them or do anything? No. Yeah, you just noticed that a man was hot. That's normal, you know? It's such a weird double standard because women are always just like, oh, she's gorgeous. Oh, my God, she's stunning. Oh, my God, marry me. Like, they just have no shame about it and they don't mean anything by it. It's literally just this aesthetic appreciation.
It's almost like there's a societal pressure on men to suppress all those type of external emotions. And I think there's something called, that rhymes with noxic nastinality.
Yeah, which we could definitely plunge into in other episodes because that does factor into this movie quite a bit.
Yeah, the idea of what makes a man. And I was almost going into Now You're Man Man by DVDA, which is this theme song to Orgasmo, but...
Yeah.
Again, that plays into everything.
Yeah, and I think being trans is kind of helps, and being asexual also probably helps when that I just don't give a shit, and I don't feel the need to perform in any particular way. I'm not androgynous and a little bit with my fashion, but, you know, I know some trans people definitely enjoy their androgyny, whereas, no, I'm just a boring old fart, and I'm just a boring old man, but yeah.
You are infinitely more stylish than I will ever be.
Thank you. But finally, science fiction and how that uses nudity. So, first of all, thank you, Alan Moore, for giving us Dr. Manhattan. Just
big blue wang.
Big blue wang out almost all the time, and it's totally normal. I don't look at him. I know when, you know, most people first see that character go, whoa, what?
Oh my God. I was looking forward to that. Because, you know, I'd read the comics, and I heard they were going to keep true to the costume choices. But it makes sense with Dr. Manhattan, at that point, a character who has lost pretty much all shreds of his humanity, or at least very much any kind of embarrassment.
He reminds me of a Greek god. And that's why the inclusion of the phallus is so important for that character, because to me what that means is that while he's lost a lot of his humanity, he still has these, like Greek gods, those sort of human urges and those petty jealousies and all those sorts of things. So, you know, he does notice that his wife's tits are starting to sag and, oh, there's a newer, cuter, younger model, and he still has a sex drive and all those sorts of things. So I think for his character, that's absolutely essential.
Here's the kicker with Dr. Manhattan. He's out of time. He knows all this is going to happen regardless.
Yeah.
So, haha.
He's just watching it happen. He's the only puppet that can see the strings.
What I like about the Dr. Manhattan wang, well, is that it wasn't a sexualized thing. People made a big deal about it.
Yeah.
Let's put in the pun. Well, I should have made a bigger deal out of it. It wasn't even... it wasn't aroused. It wasn't pulsating. It was just... a dick.
Yeah, you never see Dr. Manhattan, you know, in action.
He's just there. It's amazing how I can try not to make a pun here. The tiniest thing. Oh, I'm going to be full of these. It's amazing how the tiniest thing sets so many people off in the most weirdest fucking way.
Yeah.
How dare the blue guy on the screen have a penis?
Yeah, it's...
What, you want to be a fucking Ken doll?
Yeah, and so often in science fiction, that does happen with androids or aliens or something, that they're just smooth between the legs.
Yeah.
And there isn't even a sign of any kind of genitalia at all.
Well, speaking of one of your favorite subject matters, they play into this in Alien Covenant.
Yeah.
The idea of David becoming this... He essentially sexually assaults...
Daniels, yeah. Yeah, he jumps on top of her and he kisses her and he's pressing her down and it's just... horrible.
He's performing a toxic masculinity, but he also doesn't have literally the equipment to follow through with that.
Ridley Scott really has a fascination with that, because Ash
assaults Whipler, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, this sexual frustration. You know, Ridley Scott is an old man from a very different time, so he assumes that if anyone is of sufficient intelligence, sexual urges are going to factor into that. And, I mean, I think I'm fairly intelligent. I just don't have a sex drive, Ridley Scott, so...
Again, it's almost like humans are fucking complex and weird. I wish more people would get that notion.
Yes. Yeah, everyone, well, at least should only start out life with those very dogmatic ideas and, no, life is this way, and then as you get older, you go, oh, wait, no.
I would argue they don't need them, but that's just me.
Yeah.
Lifelong atheist.
No, I mean, as a kid, I mean, I was an atheist as a kid as well. Well, I was a dogmatic atheist, that's the thing. So I'm coming from the other direction where I was like, no, I only believe in what can be quantified. I only believe in, and, you know, I think... Oh, yeah.
So that's why you like Ridley Scott, because all of his atheists are dogmatic.
Yeah, I've been watching Raised by Wolves lately, Jesus Christ. But I think the best example of nudity in science fiction, at least recently, is Altered Carbon, which is really fascinating. So there is so much nudity in that show, just an insane amount. There are people fighting nude. There are people just having full-on dialogue scenes totally nude, and it's very effective from a storytelling perspective.
Isn't Altered Carbon the one where it's all about, like, you know, body swapping and identity? So that really does make sense that, you know, as a concept, like, as a society, if the body is just a vehicle, like, if a body is just a car, and...
Exactly.
You prang a car.
Yeah.
No big deal. You scrape the bumper. Oh, well, it's just, I'll just get a new one.
Mm.
It's amazing how much that will change body politic and... Yeah, nudity and stuff like that.
And because this is a transhumanist narrative, showing us something like this, and it really does force us to question, at what point do we lose our humanity to technology?
Mm.
And this is a world where bodies are called sleeves, and depending on how wealthy you are, you could get a clone of your own body, you can make all sorts of augmentations, you can have a synthetic body, or it's the body of a stranger.
Mm.
So each one of those scenarios really changes the way you feel about the body you're living in and how people respond to it, and just, oh, I think the whole concept is just so clever.
Yeah, it's a great concept, and it sounds to me like a more intelligent version of a movie from a few years ago called, was it Gamer? Jared Butler?
Yeah, and there was another one with Bruce Willis, which I can't remember what that was called.
Oh, you mean Looper?
No, there's one where everyone walks around in these...
Avatar? Advocates.
I think so, maybe? But yeah, something like that.
I've not seen it.
Everyone has, I think, their android bodies or synthetic bodies of some description, but everyone's at home in their little VR chambers.
Well, in Gamer, it's people controlling other people to do either war games, where people are going and murdering other people in a simulated... in literal real combat.
Ender's Game style.
Or people inheriting other people in, like, second lifestyle thing, and what happens to your personal body autonomy when you're forced into a situation where you have to give up your body to be an avatar for someone else, and they can do whatever perverse fucking shit they want to do to you, and you have no control over it. You might have a memory, you might not have. I think the people who are being controlled are conscious as well, so that makes it an even extra level of freaking horrendous.
I think overall, all these genres actually, even including comedy, it demonstrates that nudity is a source of anxiety for most societies and most individuals. And it's funny, you know, people can see our faces and our arms, and if it's hot enough, yes, sometimes I wear shorts, so yes, they can see my legs as well. They're seeing a lot of my body, and they can make judgments on that. And yet somehow, for whatever reason, we go, oh yes, for this area sort of between the neck and the knees, no, it's too confronting.
Well, there is literal nonverbal communication, so I think that's one of the things of, like, society. You know, you're inclined to have things open. This is why don't wear a helmet into a bank. You know, things like that. People expect a certain degree, or at least in face-to-face communications, of course. Communications like what we're currently doing, being voice only, is a different set of things. This is why, you know, you have to be more understanding and patient with the other person you're communicating, so you can leave pauses, you're not talking over each other, and I apologize profusely if I do that.
Yeah, it takes a long time to learn how to do that. I've been podcasting on Skype or whatever for like 10-15 years.
I'm just starting to do this. But it's also funny how we body police at the same time. And God, we are a mental species. It's like, we both want to say you do not fit into the mold of society, but when you do fit into the mold of society, you need to cover that shit up. We don't want to see that, but secretly we want to see that. because yes. All the media are selling you sex.
Yeah.
Every freaking day.
Oh, I mean, the way underage girls are sexualized, especially those who develop early and who have big boobs. I know so many girls who developed D cups or bigger in high school, and the way they would be treated was as if they were doing this on purpose. Like, they were trying to get attention, or they were trying to be promiscuous. Like, what the hell?
It's kind of fucked up, the sexualization of children. God, there's been the whole dispute of this cuties thing, and a lot of it seemed to start off as a very much the American versus European ideas regarding how to portray the victimization and the exploitation of children, and now it's just turned into a clusterfuck of everyone going, you can't talk about this subject at all because you're exploiting children.
Yeah.
Well, I have comments on particular body types in Verhoeven, but we'll get to that in a tick, because we're starting to be, and I'm just trying to nudge it back into the conversation. So just quickly going back to this minute, because this is also the moment we find out that Fredrickson has died. It's non-verbally communicated. Literally, they're talking about striking. Reed turns up and the room goes quiet because they know what happens. Beautiful visual storytelling.
I'm glad that it wasn't that typical scene where, say, for example, Murphy gets shown to his locker, but it's Fredrickson's, and then they take the old name off and put the new name on.
It is a completely different locker, but the presumption is that this locker belonged to another guy that ended up like Fredrickson, probably one of the four people that died before Fredrickson did. When you're probably watching this for the first time, you don't really think about these things, especially because of how this movie does really pepper in a lot of information. Man, goddamn, this minute is really well constructed. We are going a little bit hyperbolic on the nudity, but really the nudity is a very small thing, but it's just a great subject.
Well, it's a really fascinating subject, and we're not going to get too many opportunities in later minutes, so may as well get it out of our system now.
I think there might be a boob flash in the disco scene. The colours are so muted and bright, and you really don't see anything.
Well, I think the point of this scene specifically is just the revolutionary idea of unisex changed rooms,
And we've already talked about this, I think, last minute. This is a concept Verhoeven would later revisit in Starship Troopers.
Yeah. I love his approach to gender and sex. I wish more things were like this.
Well, do you have any more things you want to talk about?
Well, the chief says that police officers don't strike, and I've been thinking about that and going, well, why would you have that attitude? Because wouldn't you be pretty pissed off about the situation as well? You're losing all these men, you're being controlled by OCP. But I wonder if it's from his perspective he's thinking that we're the only thing standing between society and OCP taking over that society completely.
I only disagree in the sense of, actually, that's a good take, don't get me wrong. I only disagree because I think Reed is supposed to be the symbol of, okay, so he's a sergeant, so he's definitely got seniority, he's got longevity.
A sergeant, right?
Yeah. Reed is supposed to be the cop that everyone probably should look up to. The guy that's still doing his job despite all the shit. He's also the guy behind the desk, so he can't go out, but he has to deal with all the fallout. I think that's why it makes it so important that when Reed turns up to clear up Fredrickson's locker, everyone just kind of shuts up. Okay, so it's funerals tomorrow. Department requests all officers on duty to attend. Any donations to be given to his lackey. That just shows this is something that happens so many times.
Yeah, maybe he's just like, I don't strike. I don't want to do the paperwork.
Yeah. But I think Reed is the guy that has the ideal. He is like what we would, society would call, especially all the turmoil going on, he is the guy we would call the good cop.
Yeah.
This isn't Star Trek where all the admirals are evil. This is like, a cop show typically means like sergeants tend to be more respected. That's my take, at least. He's a guy that's been doing it long enough. He doesn't have to put up with the OCD. He just knows that there's crime out there and we're the ones to have to fight it.
Yeah. He has a Batman complex.
Well, Batman in some situations is pretty much a cop without a badge.
Yeah.
Because the badge restricts me.
So, should we get to the gaslighting of RoboCop?
Alex, how do you feel?
I feel fine, Dr. Norton.
This minute begins with Novak saying, pacify these people, and ends with a boy approaching a door in Tehran.
So, my one-line note is, it's the juxtaposition of American military brutalism reinforced by the media, and the sepia-toned Middle East implying the boy will become an insurgent.
Yeah, I sort of had a similar note where I just said, having forced myself to endure the Michael Bay Transformers series, this now reminds me of his fetish for the military and American exceptionalism, complete with the camera angles and sepia tones. So, yeah.
Yeah. for the record of the podcast, I'm using a not current version of RoboCop 2004, and unfortunately Netflix has stopped showing it, so I couldn't...
Yep, it's on Stan.
So my copy doesn't have subtitles for the Middle Eastern sections when there's... I literally spaced on trying to think out what the language would be.
Farsi, Persian.
Yeah, so I'm judging this purely on cinematography.
Mm.
And that's why I was like, due to the, you know, juxtaposition of the camera angles and the camera and the lighting and the color grading and stuff like that, my brain was there going, what we're seeing is the radicalization of the Middle Eastern youth.
Mm.
I don't know if that's true or not because I can't tell what the subtitles are saying.
It says, Navid, get away from the window. Mom, they're here. They're coming. And then the door opens. Yeah. Come here. Come here right now. And then some guy walks in. Arash, Navid, you stay with your mother and your sister and the kids. What do you think you're doing? You heard me. And then the mom's like, don't do this.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, he just walks out again. And that's about it.
We know a lot now about how radicalization works. Ironically enough, these over displays of power, typically by Americans in the Middle East, have been counterproductive in trying to stop insurgency. It actually inspires insurgency because their homes are being invaded by a fucking outside force that's trying to kill them.
Yeah, isn't that funny? Who would have expected that?
I'm hoping this was a genius movement on the filmmaker's course because we've not seen it for 5 minutes and all of a sudden we got this, wow, great juxtaposition shot. And as I said in the first episode, we will call out the good as much as we call out the bad. I think this, cinematically, was a really well-constructed sequence.
Yeah, I think on this point at least, it is making a point in terms of, yeah, if you...
Still got nothing to do with RoboCop.
Nothing to do with the actual narrative at large, but yes, that contrast of if you put more military presence in a place, you're going to poke the bear, you're going to provoke people, you're going to scare them.
Yeah, it's brilliant, and it's almost needs to be in another film.
I mean, you've seen the way, especially Americans, freak out when you tell them, okay, we just don't want you to go out so much during lockdown, and we want you to wear a mask, and they're just like, freedom! And shoots guns in the air.
So, I had a thought while I was in the shower earlier.
Shower thoughts.
Because, as you know, all the best thoughts are in the shower.
Yes.
And it's funny because I was thinking about the juxtaposition of post 9/11. How many Americans were on board to curtail all their freedoms because to protect us from the crazy brown people? We've got a deadly virus that has killed more people than the September 11 attack.
Oh, yeah, but there's footage of that, whereas, nah, COVID's not real. That's just a conspiracy.
The president says it's a hoax.
Oh, yeah. Even people who know people who have died from COVID are just like, yeah, but I don't think it's as bad as they say it is. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The cognitive bias is astounding. Like, the backflips you have to do mentally.
Yeah. Holy shit. All these people that are screaming about my freedoms with their masks are probably the same people that gladly shuffled through the Patriot Act where nobody had read it, which curtailed a lot of freedoms. Freedoms that are still being curtailed today. The whole taking your shoes off the airport. One guy had a fucking shoe bomb. 20 odd years later, we're still taking our shoes off. Even though...
You just never know, man.
Doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
So it's weird how... I guess this is why I just will never be a conservative, because I just don't think I'll ever get that mindset of just like... It's cognitive dissonance and... internal screaming.
That's the thing, is like centrism or conservatism is fine when it's just how you live your own life.
Yeah.
But when you start telling other people,
yeah,
that's when you run into trouble.
Well, conservatism by its own construction is about preserving power and or wealth.
Mm.
It's about preserving the systems that help you keep or gain power and wealth.
Mm.
Those two things are intrinsic.
Yeah. Cue a reference to Maggie Mayfish's Breaking Bad.
Oh, that was so good, and I'm gonna have to...
That was so heavy, oh my god.
That was brilliant, and I was just there going, fuck, I might have to watch Breaking Bad. I need to watch that docudrama that she talked about.
Yeah, and I'm doing my Transformers video essay, and one thing I want to tackle is patriarchy and why we inherently... Transformers is a franchise about these big, powerful, masculine bodies. Everyone is, especially compared to humans, and what that means and why we inherently, especially even as children, worship that.
It could so easily be a farce. You know, the idea of Bayformers, how he constructs his films, it could be satire, it could be satirical, but it's not. We just literally know instinctively watching this is meant to be taken seriously. It's the grandiosity and the the self-importance of it. We know it's not satire because there's no nod to the camera, there's no wink, there's no...
Well, there's a lack of coherence too, because yeah. if it's satire, it gets straight to the point. Satire yeah. has something to say. These films don't consciously have something to say, but in doing so, it really tells says a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. That's been a common thing lately on, especially with online discourse. This is what the edgelords, the alt-right, tend to kind of do whenever they say something really shitty that's not funny. They just go, oh, it's satire, you just don't get it. And it's just like, no, I know what satire is. You're fucking being a racist prick.
Yeah. Yeah, satire takes more brain cells than you possess. Yeah. So.
Let's lighten the move and talk about nudity.
Yeah. Have you got any more notes for this minute?
Oh, I've got almost a page full of notes. Okay.
Oh, yeah, let's get into it, man.
I'm not going to go through everything. So because I wanted to analyze Paul Verhoeven as a filmmaker, I decided I want to find out how he's used nudity past and post Robocop.
Mm.
Now, I'm not going to go and track down his entire library. He's only made like about maybe a dozen, maybe 15 full-length feature films.
Mm.
He's done a lot of TV as well and some short films. A lot of that stuff is going to be impossible to find down. And a lot of it's also he pretty much, I think his first English-speaking film was Soldier of Orange. And I think every movie post Hollow Man.
Hollow Man's got a lot of dongus.
Yeah, I didn't see a lot of dongus. So, okay, I cheated a little because I don't have an opportunity to see all these movies. I can't get all these movies. I don't have the time to watch 20 odd hours worth of hard to find foreign films.
Coward.
I do own a few of Verhoeven's Hollywood efforts, but there's a website called AZ Nude, which is basically Mr. Skin, but free. So I thought, I'm going to look at all his filmography, try and find all the movies that have got nudity in them. Fun fact, all of Paul Verhoeven's movies have got nudity in them.
Nice.
And here's a few things I've noticed. So he does tend to have a lot of varied differences with how he handles nudity and sex in his films. It ranges from humor. He uses a lot of humor with nudity. I noticed that a lot of his humor tends to be a lot of character. It's not just gags, for the most part. It's also, it's interpersonal, you know, relationship stuff. You know, it's building character and relationships. He's done a lot of topless stuff. I think he's done probably more topless than full frontal. However, oh yeah, he uses Rutger Hauer a lot. So I've seen a lot of Rutger ass. But no peen. So.
Oh, what a shame.
I know. I mean, I could probably hunt that down.
Hunt down that peen.
Hunt down the Rutger peen. Like Tears in the Rain. Just dropping off the... Anyway!
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe.
No, you're not doing Rutger Hauer Blade Runner.
No, what a shame. But we can still make Blade Runner references on Blade Runner 2049.
I'm sure there's probably some, like, Ryan Gosling peen out there somewhere.
Yeah, probably. Deepfake it.
He also uses a lot of symbolism with his nudity, and he uses a lot of power dynamics. In some of these cases, because it's non-English, I'm just looking at the cinematography, I'm looking at the camera angles, I'm looking at the acting, lighting, stuff like that. And his power play dynamics when it comes to these nudity scenes are really good. Like, some of them are like, wow, that's pretty impressive. I think he's one of those guys that people think of Paul Verhoeven, they think of freaking Showgirls.
Yeah.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, that's definitely got a lot of nudity.
So I'm trying to condense like 15, 16 movies, not including Robocop.
I'm wondering if, you know, talking about the anxiety around the male form nudity there, aside from homophobia, I'm wondering if part of that anxiety stems from circumcision, you know, that we have a lot of cultures that are weirded out by just the natural look of a penis for some reason.
Yeah, there's definitely got to be, well, from our perspective, due to being in a predominantly Christian society, regardless if we're in secularism, it's still being structured by all these things. There's a lot of that body shaming going on. Yeah, it's almost weird how we as a society don't want to see that part of the body. Here's the other thing with Verhoeven. He has one explicit crotch shot of the female anatomy. God, that sounds really clinical when I say that. There's only one crotch shot that I can find that was very explicit, and that was in Basic Instinct. Again, another infamous
yeah.
nudity story. thing.
Yeah, I forgot he directed that, of course, yeah.
Yeah, so, but he does a lot of Full Frontal as well. Again, I find his, it's not just I'm doing exploitative porn.
Mm.
He has so much range, and yeah, some of it's very nice and cutesy, some of it's violent.
Mm.
I've got at least 3, maybe 4 notes on when he's used rape in a film,
mm.
and including, and this is also a kind of a bad trope as well, the rape of love.
Ugh, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think rape in a story is fine if there's a point to it, but yeah. I think, or especially when one of the last Tomb Raider games came out, and to show that Lara was a badass, oh, she got to get raped, so that's how you know.
Okay, that was the Tomb Raider remake.
No, it's a later one.
I know the scene. I've played this game many times. It's one of my all-time favorite games.
Oh, no, I was referring to a later one from about 2014.
No, the sexualization of Lara.
No, she's on the boat. She gets on the boat with this crew and they're doing research, and then one of the guys comes onto her.
That's the first game of the reboot series, and it's not sexual in the game.
Ah. Yeah, no, I've not played that one. I've only played the one from, like, 2015.
I would cut to the footage, but all my game footage got wiped.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
It's not explicit, though. It's just, one of the... I mean, it's probably in every Tomb Raider game. There's probably some element of this.
The funny thing is, there's one very suggestive moment in Tomb Raider 1. And this is the bit that caused the uproar, because they use it in the trailers. And I wish they fucking hadn't. So there's a scene in Tomb Raider 1. This is... Okay, so Tomb Raider 1...
Yeah, I mean 2013.
Yeah.
Because
it's Tomb Raider, Shadow of the Tomb Raider, and Rise of the Tomb Raider.
Mm.
I could just literally pull it off my X-Bone 1 shelf, but that takes effort. So in the Tomb Raider reboot game, Lara isn't... Well, for lack of a better term, she's not a killer. She's just an archaeologist. It's her... Again, a bad term. It's her breaking and remake game.
Mm.
So there's a moment where they find the bad guys on the island, and she gets her weapons removed, and she's, like, bound up, and you've got to navigate your way out of there and, you know, try and regain your weapons and stuff like that. Very typical game mechanics.
Yeah.
But there's a cutscene where you get into a hiding spot, and it cuts to the...
Cutscene.
It cuts to the cutscene. Thank you. And a guy grabs you and it pushes you against the wall, and it's very leering, it's very suggestive. And that's the footage they used in the teaser trailer.
Ah.
What immediately happens in that moment is that Lara knees him in the guts and breaks out of her chains, reaches for the gun. There's a struggle for the gun, which is a quick time event. And if you succeed the quick time event, you blow his brains out.
Mm.
That's the first time Lara kills a person. It is actually incredibly powerful within that game. The look on Lara and her reactions and her emotions really pay off in that.
Mm.
This is why I hate the marketing around that section, because you play it in the game, it is an incredibly powerful moment, but because you gotta fuck the lead character, they made the marketing about raping the lead character.
Yeah, and also the fact that it's just such a common trope, you know, when do our male protagonists get violated like that? You know, it's usually a character like Theon Greyjoy, where he's quite a... Oh, there's the cops. Oh, no.
Oh, no. Cheese it, it's the feds.
Yeah, oh, it's the RoboCops.
You're not talking about RoboCop enough.
Oh, yep, sorry. A character like Theon Greyjoy, you know, this secondary character, and it shows him sort of being broken and becoming quite a pathetic character. So
he is literally castrated, isn't he?
Yes. And then,
so that's literally the ultimate demasculizing power move.
Or in Lawrence of Arabia, it did really happen that T. Lawrence was raped in prison. They just sort of gloss over that. You don't want your hero to that's not manly. So yeah, it is.
Yeah, because, you know, it's also the it's not gay if you're the one giving it.
Weird. It's almost like when dogs hump each other. That seems to be what it is, you know. If you do it over the tail, it's not gay. Another thought I had, though, was that it's funny how culture shifts over time, and obviously our attitudes towards sex and gender and our bodies change a lot. And if you look at ancient Greek artwork, it's very male-fixated, and it's all about the male form, and they're very good at depicting the male form. Not so good with women. Most women in art kind of just look like men, but with these little round things they call tits attached to the front, not the way they should.
There's a little reason for that. for specific periods is that it was uncouth for a woman to disrobe in front of a man and things like that.
Yeah, that's quite funny.
So they would get men to pose, and then the artist would make a very masculine woman and then give her tits.
Like they'd never seen a woman before. But, well, the interesting thing with the Greeks specifically was that their philosophy or the idea about the female form is that it's basically a prepubescent boy.
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, man-boy love going on in that culture, so that's a whole other thing. But, yeah, it is, well, I mean, technically they were right. You know, this is long before hormone replacement therapy, but it turns out you put testosterone in a woman, they basically turn into teenage boys.
Yeah. Again, biology, fucking weird.
Life finds a way.
Just quickly going back to the rape of love one, that was from the movie Flesh and Blood, and it's literally a scene where Jennifer Jason Leigh is captured by the bandits. It's been a while since I've watched this movie, and I kind of was bored with it, so I might have to watch it again as an adult. I mean, I found some of it titillated because I was a young teenage boy, and there's tits. But it is a thing where Jennifer Jason Leigh is about to be raped by one guy, she grabs a branch on fire and burns his ass off. She's captured by the rest of them, literally held limbs akimbo for Rutger Hauer to strip down, and they are literally using her as a battling ram onto his dick.
Ah.
And she falls in love with him.
Okay.
Subtle!
Which is what they do in the Game of Thrones TV series. So in the book with Daenerys and Drogo, he actually turns out to be quite a gentle and an empathetic man, at least towards her.
Yeah.
He's very gentle and, you know, even though they can't speak the same language, consent seems to be a thing for him.
Yeah.
In the show, HBO is like, nah, just make it rape. Just make it rape.
Yeah, again, it's, oh no, I'm now in love with my rapist.
Actually, it's a very popular fetish amongst women. There was this survey done ages ago, but a lot of women do have this fetish, and it's such a strange thing. Like, I actually have a friend who has dealt with sexual assault, but she's also into that. But she's not into those experiences that happen to her. So there's a real divide between fantasy and reality, and that's what a lot of people don't remember. It's very easy to forget, apparently.
You can play the fantasy as long as you establish consent beforehand.
Mm.
And especially if you're going to play act something like that, get it written down.
Yes.
This is the reason why porn studios have a very comprehensive list of what the performers will and will not do on screen. Because if they record something they didn't consent to and they said no and it still happens, he can get sued.
Mm.
And, you know, probably charged, because this is America, they probably won't. Oh, moving on, because I have one really weird note about Flesh and Blood.
Mm.
Got to see a naked Bart Simpson.
Okay.
I'm leaving that pause in there.
Yeah.
Nancy Cartwright is the voice actor for Bart, is a woman. She's a Scientologist, but we don't hold that against her. Yeah, she gets her tits out of this.
Yeah.
How's that for some trivia?
That's weird, because her voice isn't that different from Bart, so just,
Like
hearing that voice and then looking at boobs, I'd be very confused.
It's on the internet.
No, I think actually, you know what, I would actually say, seeing Tara Strong naked would be weirder to me, because, like, that's the voice of Bubbles.
Oh, God.
No! No! And Dill Pickles! No!
Okay, look, you know what? I'm a man. I have urges. I like female bodies. I don't like naked female bodies.
Yep.
I like to see images or whatever of Tara Strong naked. But man, that would be fucking weird. You'd be like, why am I hearing Princess Twilight? No!
Yeah, like, sexy photo shoot, fine. But if I see, if it's video and I can hear a voice and it's just, nope, nope.
I can probably disassociate enough, but I think it would be weird now because Tara Strong is such an identity in and of herself, like...
Sorry, I just got distracted because I was like, you know what? What if, like, Frank Welker's wife is like, talk to me like Megatron tonight? And then the next night it could be like Fred from Scooby-Doo or some shit.
Oh, God.
Oh, Jesus.
Casey Kasem just, get ready for some action, honey. I'll bet you fucking Matt Lillard fucking does Scooby-Doo in the bedroom. He seems like the kind of dude that would do that.
On Reddit, I saw this comment by a guy who was talking about why, so it was like, ridiculous reasons your relationship ended, and I can't remember which character it was, I think it was Shaggy, but he kept doing some fucking voice. like joking around while they're having sex. And she's like, I can't take it anymore.
Oh, God. I'm just thinking of all these goddamn voice actors, and you know, it's like, you know, Rob Paulsen going, hello, nurse!
That's actually really cute. I think that would actually... You get points for that.
Okay, two words, Kevin Conroy.
Oh, I mean, he just...
I don't want to know Batman's own face.
Oh, I mean, he just makes everybody as wet as a duck in a puddle, just... Anyway.
I'm keeping all this in. This is going to be the crowning achievement of this podcast. We talked about cartoon characters having sex sounds.
Yeah. Oh, man. It just occurred to me that Peter Cullen also voices Eeyore. Jesus, I'm not saying anything.
Oh, my God. I do have a Star Trek reference.
What?
In the Paul Verhoeven nudity research, I forgot I do have a Star Trek reference.
Well, shit.
Oh, yes, very important, yes.
Oh, so in the movie Total Recall.
Yes.
There is the infamous three-breasted woman.
Yes, and she is,
Ensign Sonia Gomez.
Well, since it's listed as intelligence circuitry, why not? After all, working with so much artificial intelligence can be dehumanizing, right? So why not combat that tendency with a little simple courtesy? Ah, thank you.
Yeah, the cute one who never came back.
Yeah, she was supposed to come back, but she didn't do it. And I've got her science signature card right here.
She's so cool. I miss her. Maybe I'll have to write a fan fiction about her now.
No, she was in two episodes. Samaritan Snare and...
Yeah, but she wasn't, like, recurring.
The first Borg episode, Q Who.
Yeah.
So, and that's also the, infamous three-breasted woman.
Baby, you make me wish I had three hands.
Well, I think you're doing just fine with two.
Yep.
Again, a lot of humor, a lot of subversion does become a recurring thing.
Oh my God, well, actually, that's kind of relevant. So, originally, Deanna Troi in Star Trek The Next Generation was supposed to have multiple titties.
Yes! I remember that.
Yeah, everyone shot Roddenberry down. I'm just like, how are we going to configure this? How does that work? Why is this too distracting? And yes, in Total Recall, it works because it is a joke.
Yeah. It's also in the brothel scene, you know, so it's that fact where sex workers are a thing. And he got the joke later on. It's like, I wish I had three hands. And he had three hands.
Yeah. So the idea of Deanna Troi as a character having to do all those serious scenes while she's got a big old otter strapped to her chest, it's just, that's not feasible. That's really not, it's distracting.
That episode of TNG where she's communicating to that other species that's in an alternate dimension and they need hydrogen to cause an explosion to free the ships. And
oh,
she's
yeah.
just floating there on that weird hardness going... Who are you?
Like, yes.
Oh, God, that's kind of weird and cringy.
It's a horrible shot.
I'm now imagining that with extra things flopping down. It's just like...
No.
I mean, I kind of would hit it, but... I still think Marina Sirtis is a very, very attractive lady.
I'm Team Beverly Crusher.
But I must admit, I've always been Team Bev in it comes to TNG.
Get on that MILF train.
Bev in TNG, Dax in Deep Space Nine. That's mine.
Yeah, I'm a basic bro and I like Seven of Nine, but...
Everyone likes Seven of Nine.
Yeah, but that was actually what I was going to come back to earlier, is I love when a character is, you know, the director is clearly just like, you know, fetishize her, objectify her, and then she ends up being the best character.
It's almost like the writers went, you know what, fuck Rick Berman, let's actually write some character for this big-tittied monstrosity that he's initially wanted insert into the show to gain rating.
Yeah, like her costume does not make sense. As a costume designer, I can say that her costume does not make sense cohesively within the show. Like, if you wanted to do an objectified character in the style of Star Trek Voyager, that's not how that costume should look. It's just basically make it as tight. It's what, keep going tighter, tighter. But my point was, yeah, so a character like Seven of Nine, or... going back to Transformers, Megan Fox's character, Michaela Baines, named after Michael Bay. They are the most competent and complex characters in their stories, and that's just a miracle.
So Gail Simone on Twitter, she actually posted a thread on, like, you know, people in science fiction, like, you thought were, you know, basically what was your sexual awakening? And I posted the fact of, like, I always thought, you know, Troi was attractive. But when she put on the actual uniform, I thought she was super hot. I think I'm just wired that way, but...
Women in uniform.
I think she was more attractive. I actually think the actual Starfleet uniform accentuated her body a lot better than that fucking V-line one.
For me, my sexual awakening was Quark and that Klingon lady. No, actually, you know, the Cardassian lady. Yeah.
Oh, God, I'm trying to think of there's a couple of Cardassians, but they've never been made characters that are female.
Oh, no, this is Cardassian woman who shows up and they used to have a relationship and, he's trying to help her out.
So the first of Verhoeven's probably big sex films in Hollywood was Basic Instinct. And a lot of that nudity, and I actually probably say pretty much all of the nudity on the sex in that show, is power play.
Hmm.
Okay, so the beginning opening of your film is the sex scene between, what we presume is Sharon Stone and the rock star or something like that, who she murders with the ice pick. They repeat that sex scene almost shot for shot when she bones Michael Douglas for, I think, the first time.
Hmm.
And it's the subversion that she doesn't kill Michael Douglas with the ice pick. You know?
Why was Michael Douglas kind of this leading man romantic figure for a while? I don't understand.
I have no idea, but I know he had a sexual addiction all the way up until, at least until he met and married Catherine Zeta-Jones, and she actually threatened to divorce him if he didn't get that shit under control.
I mean, you're married to Catherine Zeta-Jones, so that should be just
like, I know,
everything
right?
You need right there. Why do you need anything else?
I don't think he was fooling around. I just think he might have been a little bit too overly aggressive, but
yeah, right.
I'm not sure. That was like 20-odd years ago.
Hmm.
And I think they're still married, so obviously it's working.
Hmm.
But again, Verhoeven using sex and nudity as a powerful statement, except for the one scene where I think it's kind of implied that Douglas's character, again, kind of rapes Jean Triplehorn's character, but it's something they're both in on.
Mm.
Like, he forces her onto it, but she ends up liking it. It's like that thing they do. So again, rape. But Sharon Stone is, like, the apex predator of the movie.
Yeah, especially that idea of, I'm just going to make you enjoy this.
Yeah.
It's like, that's not how that works.
I believe in that scene, I remember the actor's name, so I don't remember the character name. So it's Jean Triplehorn is, like, the police psychiatrist, and she's one responsible for declaring if Michael Douglas is fit for duty, and they kind of bang regardless and all this other stuff. So it's a kind of fucked up film.
Yeah.
But the big one is the movie after that, which is Showgirls. Now, here's the interesting thing, cinematography. It's all over the place. Oh, here's the other thing. In some of these other movies, he does use voyeurism as part of his nudity, like people looking at people getting undressed in windows and stuff like that. This movie has practically all of Verhoeven's sex traits in it. It's got casual nudity. It's got humor. It's got exploitation. It's got empowerment. It's got depowerment. It's sensual. It's funny. It's got power play, seduction, subversion, obfuscation, rape. One of the big ones is the rape of...
I'm always fascinated by those tropes that a director or a writer always comes back to.
Yeah.
And what that says about them.
But Showgirls is about Vegas. It's about the exploitation of people in Vegas. I don't hate Showgirls.
It's about everyone got AIDS and shit. Actual quote from the movie.
Everyone has AIDS. I never hated Showgirls. I mean, I watched it when I was a teen, so I'm mostly watching it for jack-off material because it's easier to get than porn. That's too much information, I know. But I enjoyed the movie. It's not a bad film. Honestly, it's a movie I might do a minute-by-minute on, looking back at all the nude scenes.
You absolute fucking madman.
Yeah, it's probably one I might solo, no pun intended. I don't know. I mean, looking at movies where I'm thinking, I finished Kung Pao, what would I want to do next? And I was thinking, should I do something serious or do something silly? And looking at Showgirls today, I was just like, this was notorious enough that it might be worth a review. Or at least a retrospective.
Video essay sort of thing, maybe.
Yeah, but even the minute I'm excited, because as I said, looking at the cinematography of some of these shots, this is also Verhoeven using a wide variety of female bodies. That's something I'm going to get to when I finish the... just quickly going over notes. Because we're getting to movies that people know. And so after Showgirls is Starship Troopers.
Mm.
Again, gender neutral. So we're not going to go too much about that. Non-exploitative. Anyway, the sex scene in the movie is very much about an emotional bond. Like these two characters that at first didn't like each other or had like a playful rivalry, becoming closer through combat until finally the romantic entanglement.
The kiss.
Yeah. And it's also played for laughs and a bit of fun. You know, it's it's as much a freeing experience than a deep love. It's so the next or the last, I think this is the last of Verhoeven's Hollywood genres, but Hollow Man was definitely the darker, exploitative stuff. Very voyeuristic. Again, these themes of rape and voyeurism and exploitation, very much all within the camera. Oh, that's the thing, looking at all this stuff, cinematography, it's all great. It's well shot. It's, when it's exploitive, it's being, the subjectivity is being exploited, the camera is being exploitive. When it's funny, it's a bit neutral. When it's being sensual, the lighting and everything is really reflecting it. This guy is a freaking mastercraft at nudity, I guess. He's done it for 12 times at this point. The next one is the very heavy one called Black Book. That's got everything. It's got humor, eroticism, playfulness, and also power dynamics, abusive power, sadism, voyeurism, spycraft, subterfuge, romance. It also has male nudity.
Mm.
No Wang, though.
Mm.
And the movie after that, it starts to tone it down, interestingly enough. And it's very much about empowerment. And the final movie, it's a movie called L. It's got some negative stuff, but it's also probably his most casual nudity I've seen. Like, it's just two people, like, casually stripping off, getting into bed and talking.
Hmm.
So it's a hell of a kind of ride. The one through line I've noticed, though, Verhoeven tends to like to film thin, short-haired blondes with small breasts.
Yep.
And that's the exact person we get in RoboCop. The 2 seconds of nudity, short blonde hair, very thin build, small breasts.
Yep.
And here's the kicker. Talking about trans narrative, she's putting on armor. It's almost like she's strapping down her breasts. And when we see her later, she looks very flat when she's wearing a flat jacket. Or she's putting on her t-shirt. How's that for supporting trans narratives?
Yeah.
I've done my research.
And, I mean, yeah, there is the trans reading of RoboCop, so just adding more queerness in there, that'd be great.
I knew I had to tackle this thing. I didn't want to say anything because I just thought this might be a bit creepy. Because I know he's got some exploitative stuff out there, and I thought, if this is just going to be Paul Verhoeven being the sex pest for 12-plus movies, this is going to paint a very bleak picture, which is weird because of how it contradicts RoboCop. But no, he uses nudity in a lot of very ways. I can't tell what's going on in some of these scenes just because I literally don't know what dialogue is, but I can visually know what's going on. View to contextual clues, tone, light, cinematography, camera angles, zooms. Holy shit. I might do this again some other time from another film creator who's got a heavy dose of nudity, but man, this was actually a very interesting deep dive.
Yeah.
I might send you my notes, but wow, I've got a few. And all I was doing was writing down one word notes to describe the things that were being conveyed in the scene. And it just went all over the place.
Well, yeah, when I started looking into nudity and how it's used in the media, just as a general thing, it's like, wow, I could go on about this for a long time, but I'll keep it succinct.
No, it is a very big, broad subject. And if this is the only time we get to talk about this in 90 probably plus minutes, depending on, I don't know how long RoboCop is exactly, I think it's like 89 or so minutes, then that's an episode worth delving into, you know. And if people can get something out of it, I think that's probably done our job.
Hopefully.
I'm kind of spent.
Yeah,
getting another double entendre in there.
Well, I think that about covers it.
Would you like to tell the dear listeners where they can find you, Connor?
You can find me on traviandesigns.com, TRAVAN, or Alien Prequels by Minute on Facebook. And maybe I should set up that Instagram for 60 seconds to comply.
Maybe. It might be up by the time you're listening to this. I am Simon. I keep forgetting to mention that. I do Kung Pao Enter the Minute, and you can look for that on Facebook. Most of my stuff is under Fanboy Crossing. I do YouTube videos, I do vlogs. I've got some essays up on there, some build vlogs, all sorts of weird stuff, and I overthink things. So please go check that out. So until next time, see you next week, and thank you lot for indulging me on this, Connor, especially with all the nudity.
Yeah, I had fun doing the research on that too.
See ya.